Okay, what's going on, guys? We are going to do a Q&A episode. I'm actually sitting outside in my backyard. I got the USB mic plugged in, nothing super fancy. But we're going to do a Q&A outside to commemorate the first nice day in a while. We've had some just offensively hot weather, and so it's nice out today. I want to be outside. Dogs want to be outside. So we're going to do this here. I put up a Q&A box. Thank you to everybody who asked a question. Let's jump into them. I have not read any of these. We'll go for about a half hour, and then actually all of us are going to go over to this bakery that has a really nice outdoor seating, and we'll get something yummy. So we got to wait for Emmy to wake up from her nap, and then we're going to get out of here. So whenever she wakes up from her nap, or about 30 minutes, we're going to call it. We shall see. First question. Are there just some people that can't do chin-ups unassisted? No, that's not true. I've been working out for years, and coupled with dropping 12 pounds, I'm strong. I'm now lean. I still can't do them. I mean, I don't know how lean you are or how strong you are, but it is a strength to weight ratio exercise. And so you could always get stronger and you could always get leaner. The third component of this is, there's four components. There's, I guess, strength overall. There's three components. Just having a strong back, not weighing too much, and like strength to weight, and then a skill component. So if you, I don't know that you do, but let's say you have a strong enough back and you are lean enough and you could do, you know, pull downs with your body weight or whatever, then what you need to do is you need to do pull-up specific practice. So, you know, things like dead hangs or chin over the chin hold or weighted eccentrics or banded or machine assisted. You can absolutely do them. So the answer is no, there aren't some people that just can't do them. There are people out there who need to get stronger or better or leaner. Definitely one of those three. Next, any knowledge you can share about dandelion root supplements? Nope. I'm actually sitting in front of my computer. I have a feeling it might be in Legion's Lunar, the sleep aid. Am I crazy? Nope, it is not in there. So I do not know anything about dandelion root supplements. What I would do is I would go to examine.com. Examine.com is a great resource for supplements. It's absolutely what I would do if I was wondering about, you know, a new supplement. Next question. When going up in weight, is it okay to sacrifice a little form? Mostly no. The example that you gave was, example, I increased my weight in barbell squat, and the last three reps, my hips rise a little higher out of the hole. Okay, or drop weight. So that's an important piece of context. That, to me, isn't sacrificing form, actually. That is your body's natural compensation to your quads being tired. So when your quads kind of reach close to failure in a squat, your body's going to say, okay, my quads can't do this work anymore. What I have to do is I have to shift the weight more to my glutes and my hips. And so that's a natural compensatory movement for your body. I don't actually think, to me, that qualifies as a form sacrifice, because I think the squat has a very wide range of acceptable technique. And I think if you are coming up the same way you went down for the first five reps, but then the last three, your hips rise a little bit. I mean, can I just say, the squat is about hitting a certain depth and then standing up. If you did that, your squat form's good, right? I mean, there is, unless your goal is like elite optimal hypertrophy, in which case you might not even be doing barbell squats. Your goal is to hit a certain depth for the squat, and then stand up and not hurt yourself. And so if you, you know, maintained a neutral spine, even if you didn't, there's some, you know, argument that it's not the end of the world either. I think this is absolutely fine if your hips rise a little bit. Now, in general, if you go up in weight and you sacrifice form, again, there are nuances a little bit. There are specific scenarios where, again, ton of context. I don't know what you mean, not you, the question asker, but what one would generally mean if you ask this question. And so generally speaking, I'd say if you go up in weight and your form or range of motion is meaningfully worsened, then I would not do that. But, you know, that's more of a general statement that I'm saying, you know, speaking out into the ether here. In obviously the context that you gave in particular, your definition of sacrificing form is your hips shooting up a little bit sooner? Fine with me. Yeah. Next question. I like the new non-alcoholic beers. Is the 0.5% alcohol going to cause the same health consequences of alcohol, or is the dose insignificant? I'd say the dose is absolutely insignificant. I think you can be absolutely fine drinking non-alcoholic beers unless you had, you know, a million of them, you know, unless you had you know, 10 times the amount of what you would have normally drank. You know what? I'm going to date myself here, but there's an episode of Hey Arnold. Hey Arnold's trying to help one of his friends lose weight. And he keeps going to the ice cream place and getting Mr. Fudgy bars. And let's say he orders like 20 of them. And then he starts losing weight and he says he's going on a diet. And so he goes back to the ice cream and instead of ordering 20 regular Mr. Fudge bars, he orders 40 of the low-fat Mr. Fudge bars. And Hey Arnold's like, you know, that's the same as ordering 20 of the regular Mr. Fudge bars. And so that's kind of what popped into my mind here is like, yeah, okay, the dose is insignificant unless you are like compensating by, you know, swapping out all of your liquid intake for the day with these non-alcoholic beers. Otherwise, I think you're good to go. Next, advice for stopping overthinking, worrying about exercise. I feel like I can never know if I'm doing enough or the right mix of weights, cardio over the week. I just want to be healthy. I mean, if you're exercising 3 to 5 times a week, a mix of cardio and weights, you're in the 1% for exercise and health. Like, you're doing amazing. So I would already just take a beat here and just say, you know what, I'm doing fantastic. The other thing is, you know, I'm not... I want to say get a coach, join a group, you know, offload this structure of, am I checking the right boxes? Offload that to somebody else. You know, I don't like that because it's like, that's what I do. I'm like telling you to sign up for my group or something. I don't care. It doesn't need to be my group or me as a coach. It could be freaking anybody. But as a regular person, you don't need to be worrying about this, man. You just need to be doing the exercise. So I would start by saying, if you're exercising 3 to 5 times a week, you know, trying to hit those, you know, CDC guidelines for physical activity, maybe you're looking between 75 and 150 minutes of cardio, lifting weights twice a week, you're doing amazing, 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 amazing. You're getting the vast majority of the available health benefits of exercise. But if you wanted to be more sure or be more efficient or more effective, yeah, hiring a coach and offloading the organization and structure of this to somebody else who does it for a living. I think it's just, I mean, whatever, man. That's why I do what I do, so that I can help make fitness and health more accessible, lifting weights more accessible, doing cardio more accessible, have people do it because they no longer have to design their own program. They just have to show up and execute. They know how to do it. They can get their form checked. I mean, the whole point of what I do is to get more people to exercise. So I can't help but say, hey, find somebody like that. Next question. I took a month off of tracking and working out for vacation in Europe. Fuck yeah, that's awesome. Trying to get back into it, but visibly see I put on fat and struggling to find motivation with current physique. Any recommendations? My recommendation is to completely disentangle the reason you exercise with the way you currently look. You know, like, just because you currently don't look the way you'd like to look is no reason to not exercise. Now, I know I'm not yelling at you like I don't understand what you mean and you shouldn't be feeling this way. Like, I get it. We're like, I'll give you an example. My wife is feeling a little bit of this, where she's a little bit less motivated to exercise because she used to look better, let's say, right? So I understand that emotion. But future you would, like, you know, the question I would ask myself is, what would 90-year-old me say, right? What would 90-year-old you say? What would you tell a best friend if he or she were in this scenario? And what would you tell your kid if he or she were in this scenario? You know, you'd give really great advice saying, hey, like, cool, you're not, you know, you took a month off. And by the way, a month off ain't shit. I got to tell you, a month off ain't shit. You know, whatever little bit of muscle you lost, you're going to gain back within the first program of training. Whatever fat you gained, like, either was a combination of completely and utterly worth it in the pursuit of enjoying your vacation. And at the same time, I bet you, even if you had gelato for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, won't take as long as you think to dissipate if you dial things in a little bit. So, you know, you have only two choices here. And the first one is quit and stop exercising. And the other one is exercise, even though you have a little bit of this, like, meh feeling. And only one of those is going to lead to a positive outcome. Only one. You know which one. Next question. How long do you keep clients in a maintenance phase? Depends. I mean, what is a maintenance phase? I don't even know what that really is. So if you mean the idea that a person has been in a deficit for X amount of weeks and then they need a maintenance phase for Y amount of weeks, That is made up. They don't. There is no such thing as you've been dieting for this long and then you need to go to maintenance for this long. Those they are made up insofar as there's no physiological rationale for doing that, period. I'm serious. Anybody who says that, they've made it up. And I'm not attacking them because I'm not saying that's a bad idea. I'm just saying they've made up the reasoning. The reasoning has no physiological bearing. The reason you might go to a maintenance phase, let's say after a period of dieting, maybe let's say in between two periods of dieting, is so that you feel better. That's it. That's literally it. You go to maintenance between periods of calorie deficits so that you go into that second period of deficiting feeling better. That's it. Not because it helps you prevent metabolic adaptation, metabolic damage, or muscle gain, or nothing. Like, you use periods of maintenance because breaking up a larger goal into smaller chunks might make you more successful. And that goes from everything to from like a maintenance day to a 3-day refeed to a 1-week diet break to a 1-month maintenance phase. Like, they're all these fancy names for the same shit, which is spending some time eating more so you feel good, so you can break up a large goal into smaller chunks. So I keep a client in a maintenance phase. You know, let's say that we're talking about it in this context. I have a client, she wants to lose 40 pounds, and maybe she's lost 25 pounds, and she's been doing this for 4 months, 6 months. And she's like, man, I'm not feeling so great. I'm more tired than usual. I'm more hungry than usual. The scale's not moving so much. I don't really want to eat less, but I still want to lose more weight. I would probably say, cool, let's do a minimum of 2 weeks at maintenance, anywhere from 2 weeks to 2 months, and periodically check in with me to see how we're feeling. You know, at some point, you might feel chomping at the bit to get started again with your deficit. You might feel biofeedback might be really good. The workouts are good. You know, sleep is good. Irritability is low. Motivation is high. That's when we get back to it. Next question. No, you can't program for every circumstance, but would love to focus on lower body. Could the group programming be modified to focus lower and maintain upper? So what I would start by saying is we have an optional block on every upper body day. So the last block on each upper body day has a glute exercise and then either a delt or arm exercise. And it's an optional block. And I tell you in the program, I know you know this because you're in the program, pick the one that reflects what you care about more. So if you pick the glute work at the end of the upper body day, this is a really, really plenty, like more than enough glute volume, more than enough lower body volume. If, you know, you don't trust me saying that, let's say, and I don't mean that like you'd be, you know, attacking my experience or anything. Like if you just say, if you're like, yeah, okay, I hear you, but I still want to do more legs. You know, I triggered is a weird word. I don't get triggered, but like I would be like, you know, if I had a client who's like, hey, I'm doing your group program and I'm doing the optional glute stuff, and I want to do more legs, my first thought is, man, you better be bringing the intensity. Like, I would be surprised if you could survive more than that. I look at those leg days, and I think I couldn't survive my own group programming. Like, with the intensity that I would bring to those sets, I could not survive my own group programming. So I would first, if you're looking to do more legs than what we have programmed, even with the optional stuff, I would take a good hard look at your intensity first. Now, if you've done that, and you think, yeah, I'm bringing the intensity, and I still think I can handle more, then you could go one step further and maybe swap out one upper body exercise for one lower body exercise on each of the upper body days, or you can add a lower body exercise on each of the lower body days. So you could absolutely do that. You could swap out an upper for a lower, or you could just add an extra lower body exercise of your choice on both lower body days. But again, I listen, man, I'm not... You don't offend me if you're like, I want to do more. It doesn't offend me, but I just with the sole goal of being constructive and helping, I would really do an intensity check first. Next question. Just started taking creatine. Should I take it even when I'm sick? I mean, you should just take it every day, no matter what, as often as possible. But if you miss days, you go on vacation, you leave it at home, like you forget when you're sick, it's not a big deal. Just pretend like it's a multivitamin. Take it every day. Take it every day. What, you know how you think about a multivitamin? A multivitamin you take every day, but if you miss a day, you don't worry about it. That's how you should think about creatine. Take it every day. You don't think about whether it's working. You don't think about, oh my God, I forgot it on vacation. Like, it's not a big deal. You just take it every day. Take it when you're sick. And just never think about it again. That's how I would think about your creatine. Next question. My 13-year-old is interested in strength training. What age is safe to start? The truth is that there is no such thing as a not safe age. We have studies in kids like sub 10 years old, and it is, if anything, helpful from a growth standpoint. There's no downside, doesn't stunt growth, doesn't stunt development. If anything, it enhances all those things. I probably wouldn't go as far as to make that argument, but I would certainly stand on the side of like safety is just not the concern. If he's interested in strength training, that's awesome. I would try and facilitate an enjoyment with the act of moving one's body. That's what I would focus. The second question is, what types of exercises would you recommend at that age? All of them. Squats, deadlifts, presses, rows, bodyweight stuff, push-ups, pull-ups, ab moves, core stuff, lunges, split squats, everything. There is nothing. There is no, what I would recommend at this age, the thing that's more important, I don't want you to think about is it safe? What exercises should I do? What I want you to think about is how can I facilitate enjoyment in this habit so I can help my child build a good relationship with movement and their bodies? You know, can I make this fun in some way, right? Can I help, even if it's like you deviate from what you know is to be optimal, you know, can I make it fun? I want my kid to enjoy this, to build a lifelong habit. That's where I want you to think. So if he's interested, even if he does things that are not optimal, if he's having fun, that's awesome. I remember I didn't have that where I like came to my parents and I was interested in it. I probably got interested around 14, you know, freshman year. And I probably did a whole bunch of dumb shit, but like it helped me facilitate an enjoyment for what turned out to be a really lifelong habit. And so, you know, if he wants to do friggin' bicep curls because, you know, he just thinks that that's cool, like awesome, amazing, I love it. You know, he doesn't need to be like, you got to do squat, bench, deadlift. I mean, just like let him enjoy it or her, by the way. Oh, you said son. Let him enjoy it, you know, if he wants to do, you know, push-ups and then he's, you know, tomorrow he wants to do, like, it's just like, I wouldn't worry so much about the structure or what's optimal or what's safe or what he, you know, the perfect program. I would try and instill a positive relationship with exercise and body and movement and being strong and all of that stuff. So hopefully some of that word vomit was helpful. Next question. I want to build muscle, but I don't have aspirations to necessarily be a bodybuilder. My gym doesn't have any cables. We use dumbbells, kettlebells, barbells, and bands. Can I achieve optimal muscle growth? Because you use... It's so funny. You said, on one hand, you have no aspirations to be a bodybuilder, and then the next, you know, in the next breath, you said, can I achieve optimal muscle growth? Well, it doesn't seem like you're interested in optimal muscle growth because you seem to not have... And by the way, I don't judge this, by the way, because I don't have this either, but you don't have the optimal aspirations, you know, to have the optimal physique. So a couple of things. One, you cannot achieve optimal muscle growth with just dumbbells, kettlebells, barbells, and bands, because the word optimal implies the absolute best. And to have the absolute best, you're going to need machines and cables because they will have some upsides over dumbbells, kettlebells, barbells, and bands. I will rephrase this and into a way that's maybe more helpful. Can you get jacked, strong, fit, and healthy with the equipment that you listed, dumbbells, kettlebells, barbells, and bands? The answer is absolutely, 1,000,000%, 1,000,000,000%. I have a group program with 400 people in it, and all we train is with, the only thing we use to train is dumbbells, barbells, bands, and a bench, right? We, you know, some other little things here and there, some little knickknacks. I gotta tell you, people are getting super jacked. They are doing amazingly well, and so you cannot achieve optimal muscle growth without optimal equipment. But you can achieve an incredibly large percentage, I don't know, 90% of the best gains possible without that stuff. And so unless you are a pro bodybuilder, I don't think you'll ever notice the real difference. I'd say the bigger difference between having more equipment and less equipment is down to fun. You know, I'd say whenever I look at my group program, I have one group for the gym that uses like full equipment and dumbbells and barbells, of course, but cables, machines too. And then I write the home program and I look at them. I personally don't see any difference in the stimulus that I'm providing each group. I look at the home program. I'm like, dude, this is diabolical stuff. They are getting a crazy good stimulus. I look at the gym group, and I think they're also getting a crazy good stimulus. The biggest benefit that the gym group has is that they just have more options, right? I mean, they just have more stuff that they can do. They have all of the stuff you have at home, plus cables and machines and leg press and leg extension and all this stuff, so that from a variety and novelty and you know, intellectual stimulation, yeah, it's superior because you have more stuff. But I think if we're just talking about like getting jacked, yeah, you can get jacked with the equipment you listed. Optimal, if we're being pedantic, no. But, you know, that is a mega high percentage of optimal, absolutely. Next question. One free hour a day for movement. Should I alternate lift and walk days because both is just not feasible? I mean, you have 1 hour for 7 days, like every day, 7 days a week. Yeah, I think if you lifted 3 times a week and you walked 4 times a week, and then next week you lifted 4 days and then walked 3 times, like if you split that, if you had 7 hours a week to move your body, that is a ton. And if you spent half of that lifting and half of that doing cardio, let's say, yeah, that is a ton of training, by the way, a ton of exercise. So yeah, 1 free hour a day for movement, alternate lifting and walking is great. Really great. Amazing. If you wanted a little extra benefit, I would take some of that time walking and spend it doing something higher intensity. It doesn't have to be running, you know, it could be biking or rowing or swimming or playing sport or something like that. But yeah, great. I think you're doing amazing. This is a ton of exercise. Next question. What scale max heart rate do you use for zones? I found several ones based on different percentage of max heart rate. I don't use a lot of this for zones, frankly, I got to tell you. I use, how would I best explain this? I have two proxies that I care about most when we're talking about cardio. I want you to get very familiar with what a zone 2 intensity feels like, and heart rate is one of those things, and maybe we could use something like 70% max heart rate as a rough ballpark. Maybe. But I also care about sub-threshold work. I also care about what your lactate threshold is. And so that's more something that we would learn from working together, right? Over the course of watching you do a variety of different workouts, we can use some sort of algorithm. We can also do some direct testing to see what your lactate, I don't mean direct testing, like going into a lab and actually like getting your, you know, testing your blood lactate and all that stuff. I mean, doing like a proxy, like a 30 minute or a 20 minute max effort test. And we can use that as maybe, let's say 90 to 95% of your threshold. And so I don't really use heart rate for a lot of zones. I think having a heart rate range as one piece of the puzzle for establishing a zone 2 intensity, I think is good. I would rather people use the heart rate zone as a as like an initial ballpark, but then lean a little bit more heavily on subjective things like the talk test. Can you maintain a conversation, right? Zone 2 training is a level of intensity where you can maintain a conversation. If I call you while you're doing zone 2, you pick up the phone. You're not like, I can't pick up. No, you would feel fine picking up the phone and carrying out a conversation with me. Now, I would know, if I'm on the other line, I would know that you're exercising, right? That's zone 2. Can you say a 8 to 10 word sentence without going in the middle, right? Zone 2 training is, you know, the type of training you could kind of do all day, you know, for multiple hours, you know. I describe this to clients where if at the end of 60 minutes of zone 2, you should be more bored than you are exhausted. Like, you should want the session to be over because you're like, ugh, I just want to go do something else. Not, oh my God, I'm wiped out. So I'd rather use that. And I don't really do a lot of heart rate zone 3 and zone 4. I'm not saying I don't train there. I absolutely train there. But I would care more about getting a proxy for your lactate threshold pace and then using, you know, training in that, you know, 90 to 97% of that pace. I know that sounds hyper specific, but what that just means is moderate intensity work, stuff that is harder than your zone 2 work, but not sprinting. So with my one-on-one clients who are looking to take this a little bit more seriously, we use specific paces. But if I were to articulate it just, you know, in words, I would say a moderate pace that is faster than zone 2 that you can sustain for, you know, 3 to 10 minutes, right? But is not sprinting, right? And so, yes, I think you can, you know, there are, if you just Google 5-zone system, you'll be fine. I mean, most wearables will give you your zones. I don't think they're particularly helpful, if we're being honest. Again, I care mostly about establishing what zone 2 intensity feels like. We can use heart rate as one proxy for that, but then we do a lot of training sub-threshold. And one of the things I like is it's called a threshold test. It's basically a 20-minute max effort run. And it could be a 20-minute max effort row or 20-minute max effort, whatever modality you use. And we take, let's say, that pace. Let's say it's running. Let's say you averaged a 9:46 over the course of that 20 minutes. We take that and we say that that pace is about 95% of your threshold. And then we do a lot of training at that pace. Why do we do that? By the way, I'm off the rails here with this question. But why do we do that? We do that because training underneath, just underneath your lactate threshold is a really good stimulus to fatigue ratio. The stimulus you get from training at, let's say, 98% of your lactate threshold versus 102% of your lactate threshold is nearly identical. It's nearly identical. But the fatigue cost at 102% lactate threshold is exponentially greater. And so a lot of this, like, Norwegian training, if you hear a lot of this Norwegian stuff, Norwegians are pioneers for doing a lot of this sub-threshold work. So, all right, a nerdy conversation for another day. Where are we? 10:07? Baby girl is still not up here. I know sensation isn't everything, but I'm curious if I feel a glute bridge in my glutes and my hamstrings, if I'm doing something correct. My goal is for these is juicy glutes. Well, my first thought is if you feel a lot in your hamstrings, your feet might be too far out. And so what I would do is I would bring the feet in. And I would see, does bringing my feet in reduce the hamstring stimulus? The second thing I might do is not go so deep. Make sure that these are bridges, not thrusts. And hip thrusts are great, but that just might be something I would look into. And what I care, I guess, a lot about is what thing causes you to end the set. And so I get some hamstring stimulus when I do these too. But at the end of the set, I have to stop because my glutes are close to failure. So it's, you know, yes, I would love it if only your glutes were getting a stimulus. Great. But if your hamstrings are at 5 RIR, right, but your glutes are at 0 RIR, that's still awesome. That's amazing. So I would ask you, what is the thing that's causing you to fail? That's an important question. Next, how do I really know what failure is on an RDL? Yeah, it's really tricky. Trying to prevent some back pain until pop up. That doesn't pop up until after my sets are done. Both you and PT have approved my form. Yeah, failure on an RDL is completely requires context, right? So failure on an RDL could be, you know, complete failure is when you literally cannot stand up at all. You cannot get the, you know, you go all the way down and you cannot even move 1 millimeter up. That's not how you should do RDLs. I would stop when your lower back starts to round. Right? When you can no longer do a full range of motion rep with a neutral spine. Now, that isn't even because doing, you know, having spinal flexion, you know, not being in neutral is not inherently dangerous. But unless you're working with somebody who's very gradually introducing you to a flexed spine, I wouldn't give a general recommendation to allow your spine to go into flexion. Your upper back can go into flexion much, much, much stronger. But I wouldn't let your lower back go into flexion. So I would say, hey, how do I know what is failure? Well, failure is when my lower back starts to round. Now that, again, isn't always true. There's different definitions of failure. You could be taking it further to, you know, into failure. You could say, well, I'm going to let my lower back round a bit because I want some of that stimulus too, because I want to train my spine in a flexed position. So yeah, the pain that you're feeling might not necessarily be a technique thing. It might be, hey, maybe I need to stop a couple reps shy of when my lower back would start to round, or maybe I need to do fewer sets, or maybe I need to not go as low. And so it's tough to kind of diagnose this on you know, in this context. So I hope that was helpful. Next question. Just started running again after a very long time off. My lung capacity is poop. Will this just get better? Yes. Will this just get better over time? Absolutely. Of course. Oh yeah, and my knees hurt. Anything for that? A couple of things here. So, number one, you said just started running again after a long time. You're like, I suck at it. Will I get better? Of course you can. Of course you will. Dude, I have asthma, and I suck at running. I suck at cardio. I have terrible cardiovascular fitness, and I have gotten much better in the last year. But I would say it took me about a year to start really feeling better at running. So slow the hell down, you know, don't rush, don't expect crazy gains right away, but yes, you will get better with time, absolutely. The second thing is, you're starting to have some, what I would say are impact-related injuries, my ankles, your hips, your knees, a couple of things. If you, let me just do a couple pieces of advice for people that are looking to get into running. Number one is, No red line. So no workouts that take you to failure. You're not trained enough at this skill to take it to failure with good technique. And what happens is you go out for a run, your technique is solid, you start to get sloppy, your technique gets worse, it gets gets more inefficient, it gets more injury prone. You're not ready for that. So my advice, if you had all the freedom in the world, is I would start having all your runs be relatively easy. You should go into your runs thinking quality, 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 quality. No getting into crazy fatigue. If you get so tired that you feel your technique start to slip, you've gone too far. Do not do that. I want good reps, good reps, good reps. It's like if I have a client who's never deadlifted before, right? Deadlift is kind of complicated if you've never done it before. We are going to have good rep after good rep after good rep. We are not going to go close to failure. You don't have the technique. You don't have the efficiency to maintain technique under a lot of fatigue. It's the same thing with running. So if you're getting into running, first things first, your runs should be quality, not to failure, quality. The second is use an alternate modality to gain general fitness as you build up durability with running. So, you know, for the first 6 months, I did at least 50%, if not more, of my cardio work on the Echo bike because I was very prone to shin splints. And I got to tell you, I did an entire year of this work without getting shin splints. You know why? Because I gradually increased my volume. So if you go from 0 to 100, your knees are going to hurt, your hips are going to hurt, your back might hurt. Ease into it, right? And these kind of go hand in hand because your runs should not be mega hard. They shouldn't be mega tiring. They should be for quality. You should go out for your air quote run, which ideally probably is a run walk if you're just getting back into this. And it should be quality. It should be good technique, not to failure. And then if you want to kill yourself, you want to get that like, oh, I'm exhausted, I'm feeling super tired, kind of GPP, general fitness, do it on a different modality that has low impact, that has a low technical component to it. Do it on a rower, do it on a, you know, even a rower is a little bit technical, but do it on an air bike, do it on a recline bike, do it on a Stairmaster, do it on an elliptical, something that doesn't have a big technical component to it and doesn't have a lot of impact. So the downside of going to failure, let's say with running, training really hard, is you don't have the technique for it, right? And you also don't have the durability for it. So using an alternate modality that it doesn't require a technical component and doesn't have an impact component or a durability component will allow you to train harder at that thing. So I would pair up a second modality and I'd say, hey, if I'm doing two cardio sessions a week, I'm going to do one on the bike and I'm going to do my run on the weekend. And that run is going to be quality. And that Wednesday when I do my Echo bike or whatever, okay, if I want to kill myself, I can kill myself because there's no technique component and there's no impact component. So you want to kill yourself, go nuts. Hopefully that was helpful. Quite a bit more. Let me text the old wife and see what's up with this nap. Actually, I can check the baby monitor. Oh my god! I really wish you could see it. She's awake. My daughter is in her crib, awake, eyes open, hands out, arms straight out, just kicking and smiling. I can't. I absolutely can't. So I'm sure we're going to stop this any minute. Jenna will snag her, come down, and then we'll get out of here. But I'll keep answering a few here. What is lost faster, strength or muscle?
Strength.
Back in the gym after an injury, and I definitely have been humbled in terms of what I can move after the time off. Strength. Curious how correlative that loss of strength is to muscle. It does correlate. So strength, let's just say strength is, so having a larger muscle is a stronger muscle for sure. But let's break this down just in a way that I think is easy to understand. Let's pretend strength is your brain's ability to coordinate the firing of muscles, right? So it's your brain being able to tell your body how to move efficiently and how to fire effectively. That neurological component, you lose that faster. So I'll give you an example. If you stop playing golf for a week, let's say you play golf every day, you go to the range every day, you are really efficient at your technique, at your swing. If you don't go for a week, you will find out you can't hit the ball as far. You can't hit it as cleanly. You can't hit it as consistently, right? So you're not hitting the ball as far. Did you lose muscle? No. You lost technique, coordination, efficiency, right? So that neurological component, you lose that more quickly.
actual loss of muscle tissue happens more slowly, much more slowly. So you will regain that. So everything you lose quickly comes back quickly. Everything you lose slowly comes back slowly. Now, you lose muscle slowly, it comes back quickly. I know that that's kind of counterintuitive. What I mean is it takes a lot to lose, and it comes back quickly. So whatever you do lose comes back quickly. That neurological component, the same thing, only faster. You lose it relatively quickly. You gain it back very quickly. So what's interesting is we talk a lot about newbie gains. People are like, oh, when people step foot in the gym, they can add 5 pounds to their squat every week. You know, if you're a newbie, you come in this week, you squat 45 pounds, next week 50, then 55, then 60, 65, 70. And you have this crazy, what we call linear progression, where you just get stronger every single week. Most of that is improvement in neurological efficiency. Most of that is your body getting better at the act of squatting effectively. Of course, you're building muscle, of course. But a lot of the strength that you're gaining early on, it's because your body's getting better at doing that movement. So it does correlate with muscle loss, of course. You know, you lose strength doing the same thing that you would do to lose muscle, which is not training. But a lot of it is neurological efficiency. It's unlikely you've lost muscle tissue. You will feel weaker more because of that loss of efficiency, unless we're talking about a year off, right? If you're taking a year off, then you've lost neurological efficiency and plenty of muscle tissue. So hope that's helpful. I'm worried I lost a lot of muscle after taking after taking 2 months off from lifting and under eating on protein. Scale weight is down, glutes are noticeably smaller. How long will it take to regain the muscle I lost? So a couple of things. Everything I just answered in that previous question applies here as well. Your glutes are noticeably smaller. Something I didn't say in the last one is when you don't train, one of the adaptations that happens is you store less muscle glycogen. So one of the adaptations that you gain when you start exercising is you tell your muscles, hey, when we have to do this activity again next time, it would be helpful if we had more stored glycogen. So what your body does is say, okay, in preparation for having to do this activity again, lifting weights, I'm going to store more carbohydrate in the muscle so we have more energy so we can be better at this next time. So that's actually one of the adaptations you make when you start lifting. It's also one of the adaptations that goes away. So if you ever have taken a deload, let's say where you took the whole week off, you might look in the mirror and be like, wow, I look flat, right? My pumps aren't great. I look flat. I look smaller. What's happened is you've actually just lost muscle glycogen. And when you lose muscle glycogen or when you gain muscle glycogen, mostly what's happening is a gain and reduction in water weight. So when you lose muscle glycogen, you lose water. And when you lose water, you look like you are smaller. So if you haven't, in 2 months, the difference in how you look, I'd say is probably 90% down to a loss of water and muscle glycogen. 10% might be a loss of tissue, but more than anything, it's that your muscles have been wrung out of water and they look deflated. So I bet you within, you know, I'd say a week or two of training, your glutes look the same. Because whatever muscle tissue you lost is probably indistinguishable to the naked eye, but that water and that glycogen absolutely is noticeable. So how long will it take you to regain your lost muscle? I don't know, 1 month maybe, you know, 2 weeks maybe. But how long will it be before you look like you didn't lose any muscle? I'd say a week or two of hard training. Let's do two more. I'm committing to two more here. How do you develop that teardrop quad growth above the knee? Potentially with more lengthened position training. Just there's some research that more proximal muscle is grown with lengthened position work. More distal, meaning further from the middle of the body, meaning that closer to the knee, let's say. I'm not so sure that that's what I care about most. I'll tell you this. If you get really big quads, really strong quads, you get really strong at squats and split squats and leg presses and hack squats and leg extensions, you will grow the teardrop. So right now, we don't have an amazing way to bias any of the muscles of the quad outside of the rec fem a little bit, but the other portions of the quad, the other three sections of the quad, we don't have a really great way to bias one over the other. So genetics and overall quad growth are really your only answers. It's like saying, how do I develop that peak of my bicep? It's like, well, mostly genetics and then getting really big biceps. All right, last question. What is the functional and or aesthetic purpose behind hip abduction. I do them, but I don't really know why. So they grow your glute med, your glute min, and your piriformis, which are basically, let's call them your upper outer glute muscles, right? Your upper glute, let's call them. The glutes that are, closer to your hip and closer to the outside of your body. And I wouldn't put a lot of stock in sensation, but when you're doing the hip abduction, you should be going so close to failure, basically all the way to failure on these. And again, sensation's not everything, but you should be feeling it in that area. So the functional purpose is, I think, training every exercise trains a certain joint. And I think if you want good joint health, you need to be training, muscles in all of their functions or as many as possible, and joints in all of its functions or their functions. So if you're like, hey, what's the functional purpose of doing the hip abduction? Because, training the hip in all functions of the hip, flexion, extension, abduction, adduction, everything in between is probably a good idea if you care about hip health. Aesthetically, it's your upper outer glute. And so if that's something you care about, let it rip. All right, guys, this was super fun. I'm going to do more of these outside because, I really don't know what the audio is going to be like. I'm recording in Logic right now, so I'll be able to do a little bit of audio editing. And I'm using this USB mic, which is great. I love this USB mic. But I have a fancier mic I usually record with. So I don't know what the audio is going to be like. So I bet you it sounds a little bit different. But hey, man, being outside was freaking awesome. So thank you guys for listening. Thank you for asking questions. I'll see you in the next episode.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.